1970, the beginning of a new decade. A new decade, yet too young to pinpoint its direction or to give it a name. The 70s, where are they going? What will they bring? Perhaps a look at the past year can give us a hint of things to come. A look at those news events, some that are gone and forgotten, some that will always be remembered. But events that had some effect on you in 1970.
I think it is as critical, perhaps probably the most critical situation we've faced so far in the manned spaceflight program in flight.
Tonight, American and South Vietnamese units will attack the headquarters for the entire communist military operation in South Vietnam.
Suddenly, they turned around, got on their knees, as if they were ordered to. They did it all together. Aimed, and personally, I was standing there saying, they're not going to shoot. They can't do that. You know, if they're going to shoot, it's going to be blanks.
I want to develop my potential as a person, just as well as a woman.
I want the freedom not to have a husband, where women help support their children and men help rear them.
We're the fellas who build this country. We're the fellas who build the hospitals when they need them and they're sick. We build the bridges and tunnels for them to get around in. We build the schools that they want to burn down. And we also build all of the other things.
United Press International presents 1970 in Review, a documentary with the words and sounds of the year which marked the beginning of a new decade. 1970 in Review will continue after this message. After landing men on the moon in 1969, America's space program in 1970 was a bit of a letdown, if not altogether grim. In 1970, Apollo 13 was to be man's third landing on the moon.
1-0. We have commit and we have...
Apollo 11 and 12 had set the course, and 13 was to be a more sophisticated investigation of the mysterious surface of the moon.
And it has cleared the tower.
This is Mission Control Houston. We appear to have a good first stage at this point. Flight Dynamics Officer says the trajectory looks good. We show a 1/2 mile in altitude at this time.
Astronauts James Lovell, Fred Hayes, and John Swigert were more than 56 hours into their flight. Little did they know that in a few minutes their mission would turn into a suspenseful space drama. A voice with an edge of concern reported the first trouble.
Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main B bus undervolt.
Roger, main B undervolt. Okay, stand by, 13. We're looking at it.
Something was wrong. A mysterious blast in the service module snuffed out almost all of the command module Odyssey's oxygen and power supplies. The astronauts' safety and their very lives were threatened. The flight had to be aborted.
We appear to have had some kind of accident in the region of the fuel cells and the oxygen tanks. We've begun to use the limb as a device for keeping oxygen in both the command and service command module and the lunar module, and we're using the power system from the lunar module.
The danger was clear. Life supplies aboard the craft were dwindling. A hazardous race was begun for an emergency landing in the Pacific.
I think it is as critical, perhaps probably the most critical situation we've faced so far in the manned spaceflight program in flight.
One whole side of that big business. Right by the high gate antenna, the whole panel is blown out, almost from the base to the engine.
It looks like it got to the SPS bell, too, just dark brown streak. It's really a mess.
This is Apollo Control Houston at 141 hours, 31 minutes into the flight. We've had lunar module jettison. And for Apollo 13, the age of Aquarius ended at 141 hours, 30 minutes, ground elapsed time.
The combined efforts of engineers and space specialists at NASA's Space Center in Houston and the skills of the astronauts themselves enabled the crippled craft to land 6 days after liftoff. Never before had the world witnessed such a dangerous and dramatic space flight. For the United States, the first in-flight failure in space meant no landing on the moon in 1970. For Russia, 1970 was one of their biggest years in space. First, in June, two cosmonauts set a new endurance record by staying in space for 17 days, 16 hours, and 59 minutes. But the best Russian achievement came in September and November when they successfully landed unmanned vehicles on the moon's surface. Luna 16 drilled into the moon's surface and collected a sample of moon rock and returned to Earth. Luna 17 landed an eight-wheel self-propelled vehicle on the moon's Sea of Rains on November the 17th. Shaped something like a bathtub on wheels, the moon rover was said to be analyzing the properties of moon matter and sending the results back to Soviet space scientists. It was in April when the silence of space was violated with this sound. What you are hearing is a satellite transmitter broadcasting telemetric signals. But this satellite was different, for occasionally the signals stopped and the satellite burst into song, a popular communist Chinese song called The East is Red. So in 1970, Red China joined the exclusive World Space Club by launching their first satellite. Well, for communist China, the East may be red, but not as red as the faces of some British pollsters who predicted a win for the incumbent Labour Party candidate in the British parliamentary elections. Conservative Edward Heath won the election by beating out Prime Minister Harold Wilson. Heath naturally predicted his victory the night before the elections.
Labour has been taking the housewives of this country for granted because they don't appear to have got a loud voice like other sections of the community. In the privacy of the polling booth, the women of this country are going to show Mr. Wilson and his colleagues what they have been dying to tell them for a long, long time. They have had a vote now for 50 years. They will show him how they can use it.
In Northern Ireland, 1970 saw new outbreaks of clashes between Roman Catholics and Protestants. Rioting on May 10th lasted 16 hours in the troubled city of Belfast. At the end of June, five persons were shot to death, 240 persons seriously wounded. The riots were promulgated by the jailing for 6 months of Bernadette Devlin, the young Catholic female member of the British Parliament. The violence continued sporadically during the summer. If you were in Belfast during the rioting, this is what you would have heard. While fighting in Northern Ireland was a fact of life in 1970, one small country ended a war that had lasted 2.5 years. The country, Nigeria.
The tragic chapter of violence is just ended. We are at the dawn of national reconciliation. Once again, we have an opportunity to build a new nation. My dear compatriots, we must pay homage to the fallen, to the heroes who have made the supreme sacrifice that we may be able to build a nation. Great injustice, fair play, and industry.
That was the Nigerian Chief of State, Major General Yakubu Gowon, whose government forces defeated the breakaway Biafran rebels in that country's civil war. So one war ended, but other military actions continued. In the Middle East, where violations of a ceasefire agreement perpetuated distrust on both sides, and in Vietnam, where American GIs found themselves fighting in neighboring Cambodia. These stories and others next on 1970 in Review. In 1970, two words best describe Indochina: Vietnamization and Cambodia. The Vietnamese have taken over virtually the entire fighting war. American combat troops still remaining have been pulled away from hot border areas into the interior and coastal regions. And as a result, U.S. casualties in 1970 were less than half of the 1969 total. President Nixon vowed to bring home more American troops this year. So far, that's what's happening.
I am tonight announcing plans for the withdrawal of an additional 150,000 American troops to be completed during the spring of next year. This will bring a total reduction of 265,500 men in our armed forces in Vietnam below the level that existed when we took office 15 months ago.
The Vietnamization of the war is still untested. That is, the United States is still not positive how Vietnamese can fight, but more and more it's becoming an accepted, if not proven, opinion that they can. In Cambodia, Prince Norodom Sihanouk was thrown out of office in March while on a visit to Russia. This pleased the Allies because they thought Sihanouk was helping the North Vietnamese by letting them run supply lines and bases in Cambodia. The door now seemed open for action by the United States and the South Vietnamese forces. On April 30th, President Nixon made this announcement.
Tonight, American and South Vietnamese units will attack the headquarters for the entire communist military operation in South Vietnam.
This key control center has been occupied by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong for 5 years in blatant violation of Cambodia's neutrality.
The drive into Cambodia evokes surprise and considerable criticism in the Senate. The opposition spread into unlikely camps. Senator George Aiken from Vermont, usually an administration supporter, was one of the opposition.
I think it'll have a very harmful effect on some of our domestic programs, and the most harmful effect probably will come on the morale of the people of this country who had got to where they were trusting the president, believed that he was going to bring that war to an end. And I know that many, many of them will be as disappointed as I am at the decision which he's apparently made.
Finally, when the operation was completed, the president announced the mission a success.
As of today, I can report that all of our major military objectives have been achieved.
United Press International's 1970 in Review will continue after this message. Admittedly, the Vietnam War has been a unique one for the American soldier. One element that sets it apart from other wars in which Americans have fought has been the smoking of marijuana and the use of drugs by U.S. troops. UPI Audio Saigon correspondent Alan Dawson talked to some of the young soldiers about the problem.
One of the reasons, I guess most of the biggest reasons that a lot of GIs do get high over here is there's nothing to do. This place is really a drag, you know, it's a bore over here. Like right now, sitting around here, you know, we could be getting loaded. And whereas it doesn't really get you, you know, messed up at Sudswood, you know. But that's, I guess, the main reason why we smoke it.
How many GIs do you think smoke marijuana in Vietnam?
I would say approximately half, two-thirds.
No one knows what to do about the drug problem in Vietnam, and until they find a way to stop it, it probably will continue. No doubt the Vietnamization program, the continued troop withdrawals, and the consequent lower casualty rates of American soldiers made Vietnam a non-issue in the U.S. elections in the fall. So without Vietnam as an issue, the campaign centered mostly on national affairs such as the economy, violence and crime in our cities, and drugs. Both Vice President Agnew and the President campaigned vigorously for Republican candidates. Nixon spoke to the silent majority and asked them to show their displeasure with violent dissenters by voting the Republican ticket on Election Day.
The most powerful four-letter word is a clean word. It's the most powerful four-letter word in the history of men. It's called vote. V-O-T-E. And my friends, I say that the answer to those that engage in disruption, to those that shout their filthy slogans, to those that try to shout down speakers, is not to answer in kind, but go to the polls on Election Day, and in the quiet of that ballot box, stand up and be counted, the great silent majority of America.
When the campaign smoke had finally cleared and the votes were counted, both sides claimed victory. Just as the interpretation of the election results depended on which party you listened to, so it was with the topic of economy in the United States.
The American economy is the strongest in the world. This year, the number of Americans who have jobs is the highest in our history. Even allowing for taxes and inflation, the average real income of Americans is higher this year than ever before, in part because of the increase in Social Security benefits and the reduction of the tax surcharge, which will end entirely this month.
The president's picture of the state of the economy and what he was doing about it were questioned by Senator Wright Patman, chairman of the Senate Bank and Finance Committee.
The president's message is totally inadequate for the economic crisis facing the nation. It offers too little, too late. Probably the speech should have been made much over a year ago. It is a weak statement, which sounds so much like an echo of the remarks we used to hear from President Hoover in the late 1920s and early 1930s.
In 1969, Nixon's nominee for a vacant seat on the Supreme Court, Clement Haynsworth, was rejected by the Senate. So early in 1970, he made another nomination. This time, another Southern judge, Harold Carswell, who, like Haynsworth, drew immediate criticism from civil rights advocates who condemned his record as a federal district judge in Florida. Support for Carswell came mainly from the South. But here is Senator Roman Ruska from Nebraska.
Who is to judge whether he's a nominal man or a good man or mediocre? Even if he were mediocre. There are a lot of mediocre judges and people and lawyers. Aren't they entitled to a little representation and a little chance?
But Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana doesn't agree.
That's a departure from what I think most of so-called middle America want. I think they want for themselves and for their children the very best we can get in government.
When Carswell was finally rejected by the Senate, President Nixon, obviously upset, made this announcement.
After the Senate's action yesterday in rejecting Judge Carswell, I have reluctantly concluded that it is not possible to get confirmation for the judge on the Supreme Court of any man who believes in the strict construction of the Constitution as I do, if he happens to come from the South.
The seat was finally filled by a Minnesota judge, Harry Blackmun.
I'm here for the purpose of victory in Vietnam. Also, I'm here for the victory of getting the Bible reading back in the schools and prayer in the schools.
One of the other marchers here told me that Mr. Nixon is disappointing the conservatives who voted for him. How do you feel about this?
That's right.
Thank you, sir.
I think America should get back to God and get back to reality of living once again under the divine leadership of Almighty God.
College students carrying Peace Now banners, middle-aged ladies toting babies, hard hats waving giant American flags. Four dead at Kent State University. Coming up next on United Press International's 1970 in Review.
A group of young people, mostly, as far as we can determine, the university students, were milling around the downtown area in Kent, where there is a collection of bars and nightclubs where most of the younger crowd frequent. First, they were simply milling around, not really unruly or disorderly. The crowd got larger, and then the violence broke out at about midnight.
The place, Kent State University in Ohio. If you were there on May 4th, you would have seen a campus filled with Ohio National Guard units called in to quell student rioting, which began as a protest against the use of U.S. forces in Cambodia. The guardsmen had been ordered onto the campus after the university's ROTC building had been burned to the ground in the second night of disruption by anti-war students. So there you are. If a student, you're one of about 600 in a large grassy plain in the middle of campus. If you're a National Guardsman, you're part of the 100 on that same grassy plain. You would just disperse some students with tear gas. Your rifle is loaded with real bullets. You stand side by side, walking up a hill. Suddenly a student throws a rock. Then another. They're shouting. Then, just as suddenly, you turn to face the crowd. A skirmish line is formed. You lift your rifle, and for about 30 seconds, only the sounds of shooting and screaming fill the air.
Suddenly, they turned around, got on their knees, as if they were ordered to. They did it all together. Aimed, and personally, I was standing there saying, they're not going to shoot. They can't do that. If they're going to shoot, it's going to be blanks.
The shots were definitely coming my way, because when a bullet passes your head, it makes a crack. I hit the ground behind the curb, looking over. I saw a student hit. He stumbled and fell. He was running towards a car. Another student tried to pull him behind the car. Bullets were coming through the windows of the car. As this student fell behind the car, I saw another student go down next to the curb on the far side of the automobiles, maybe 25 or 30 yards from where I was lying. It was maybe 25, 30, 35 seconds of sporadic firing. Firing stopped. I lay there maybe 10 or 15 seconds. I got up. I saw four or five students lying around in the lot. By this time, it was like mass hysteria. Students were crying. They were screaming for ambulances. I heard some girl screaming, "They didn't have blanks. They didn't have blanks." No, they didn't.
When it was over, four students lay dead, 11 wounded, two guardsmen hospitalized. Some criticized the National Guard, but their leaders defended their action.
I think that the guardsmen were provoked beyond reason. I believe that we used every conceivable effort to get the people to disperse and to move long before we went, they anyone, that people were killed and wounded. We even regret the fact that it was necessary to be here.
1970 in Review will continue right after this message. Prompted by the Kent State deaths and the deaths of two black students at Jackson State University in Mississippi, the president named a 9-member commission to explore campus violence and to recommend ways of resolving student grievances peacefully. When the report was finished, commission head William Scranton revealed part of what it concluded.
It is true that the amount of campus disruption and violence certainly was much less in the period when the war seemed to be going in the direction of terminating and people were beginning to come back to the United States, for example, late last fall and this winter, this last winter and early spring. And certainly it got much stronger after the Cambodian, we all know that, after the Cambodian invasion. So the less accentuation there is of American participation and the more return of men, the more helpful it is, of course.
Students weren't the only ones involved in demonstrations during 1970. Many who called themselves the silent majority rallied around President Nixon to show their support for him and at the same time to visually display their disgust with anti-war demonstrators. In New York City, construction workers, some still wearing the bright yellow hard hats of their trade, confronted a line of anti-war demonstrators. While the students shouted peace now, the hard hats rallied with signs and slogans that said all the way USA and America, love it or leave it.
To show the students that we care more than they do, and we'll stand up even stronger than they ever will. There's nobody as strong as a United States citizen.
I'm here to show that we're in support of America, not for peace. We want to equal pullout, that's all. We want to get a settlement there.
I'm proud to be an American, and I'm glad to see once this country stood up the way it should have.
We want to say to the students that maybe today we can open the door for discussion and say to the students who have problems, we're willing to work with you. We're the fellows who build this country. We're the fellows who build the hospitals when they need them and they're sick. We build the bridges and tunnels for them to get around in. We build the schools that they want to burn down. And we also build all of the other things.
There were other displays of support for the Nixon administration. In April, Reverend Carl McIntyre, a fundamentalist preacher and anti-communist radio commentator, led a victory march in Washington.
We're here for the sole purpose of bringing prayer and Bible reading back into the public school systems of the United States of America. We're here for an all-out victory of our war in Vietnam. We feel that 47,000 of our boys have died needlessly in Vietnam, where this war could have been won a long time ago. We feel that if we bomb Haiphong Harbor, that we can make a mud puddle out of this and do away with the armament that our enemy is getting to kill our boys. This war can be over, and we can bring them home with an honorable peace.
On the 4th of July, a patriotic and nonpartisan observance of the 194th anniversary of the nation's birth was held in the nation's capital. The Honor America Day rally was conceived and organized by supporters of President Nixon. Comedian Bob Hope was a co-chairman, and Billy Graham gave the keynote address.
But I want to tell you, it's tremendously heartening to see these thousands of people from all over the country, and it proves one thing. The railroads are still running. And we have telegrams from thousands of others who wish they could be with us, but they're still stacked up over the airport. That's one nice thing about America. You can get a crowd like this together even without a football game. And what a gathering. President Nixon saw this crowd and said, my God, what did Agnew say now? And Spiro looked out of his window, saw this crowd, and said, my God, what a great time to say something.
The American court system was challenged and disrupted in a few instances in 1970. First, the trial of the Chicago Seven, which began in 1969 in Chicago, ended. The long trial had been marked by near pandemonium at times. Frequent and bitter exchanges took place between the defendants, their attorneys, and Judge Julius Hoffman. In the final verdict, the jury found all seven innocent of conspiring to incite riots during the 1968 Democratic Convention, but they convicted five of them of crossing state lines with the intent to incite riot. Coming up next on United Press International's 1970 in Review, the Middle East, a ceasefire and violations, a look for peace airplane hijackings, the death of Nasser, and from France, another leader dies.
Française, Français, le général de Gaulle est mort. La France est veuve.
The death of Charles de Gaulle reported next when 1970 in Review continues. To his people, he was more than a man, more than a political leader, more than a defender of French rights and international dealings. To his people, he was Le Grand Charles, the Great Charles. They remembered 1940 when he asked for their support.
Moi, Général de Gaulle, j'entreprends ici, en Angleterre, cette tâche nationale.
In 1944, upon his return to power, they remembered him telling them the road to recovery is difficult.
Française, Français, la route est dure, mais qu'elle est belle. Le but est difficile, mais qu'il est grand. Allons, le départ est donné.
They remember the way he campaigned in 1969. They remembered 1970 and the day he died.
Française, Français, le général de Gaulle est mort. La France est veuve. En 1940, de Gaulle a sauvé l'honneur. En 1944, il nous a conduits à la libération et à la victoire. En 1958, il nous a épargné la guerre civile. Il a donné à la France actuelle ses institutions, son indépendance, sa place dans le monde.
Tuesday, November the 12th, Charles de Gaulle was buried. World leaders attended memorial services at Notre Dame Cathedral. The country, in a unanimous outpouring of grief, said farewell to their most beloved 20th century hero. They said goodbye to Le Grand Charles. ...1970 in Review will continue after this message. The death of another leader came suddenly in 1970. He, like Charles de Gaulle, was revered by his countrymen, and when he died, they plainly showed their grief. The most powerful leader in the Arab world, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, died in Cairo on September the 28th at the age of 52. More than any other man, Nasser had shaped the destiny of the Middle East, and his death left a political void throughout the Arab world. While he was still alive, the biggest hope for peace in the Middle East came when a 90-day ceasefire agreement was reached. Talks were initiated by the United Nations and headed by Ambassador Gunnar Jahring.
I have pleasure in announcing that the governments of Israel, Jordan, and the United Arab Republic have each appointed representatives for the discussions to be held under my auspices for the purpose of reaching agreement on the establishment of a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, and that these discussions will begin on the 25th of August, 1970, at New York.
But after less than 3 weeks into the ceasefire, Israel accused the Arabs of ceasefire violations and they refused to take part in any of the talks.
If an hour after the ceasefire came into effect, missiles began moving, new sites are constructed, new sites practically up to the very edge of the Suez Canal, which can be filled within a few hours. Live missiles have been set in of the most sophisticated kind. Then we say no. then we're not meeting as equals in these discussions. Then we're meeting, we on one side, people that come in with the best of intentions for peace, and on the other side, negotiators with a revolver pointing at our heads.
To hijack one airplane is quite a feat. To hijack four planes then would have to be considered almost impossible, but in 1970 it was done. The four planes were hijacked by Palestine commandos who demanded the release of all guerrillas held in Israel, West Germany, Switzerland, Britain. The passengers were held hostage for almost a week before they were released and the demands of the hijackers were met. When they finally arrived in the United States, the passengers recalled their ordeal.
I was held hostage in the front of the plane by the Arabs. They wouldn't believe that I was an American citizen because they saw on my passport that I was in Israel 2 weeks before. They thought I was connected with the Israeli military, and I was held at gunpoint at the front of the ship.
Well, when did you first realize something was wrong on that plane?
Well, when they made an announcement that they wanted all the first-class passengers moved to the rear of the plane.
And what other instructions did the hijackers give you?
Then they were told that we were being hijacked to Beirut, which we originally were, and everyone was to remain calm and do exactly what they said.
Did they threaten you personally?
Yeah.
What exactly did they say?
Well, they put a gun to my head and a grenade in my face, and they said they were going to kill me.
I landed at the airport. We got off, and like they told the captain that we had 3 minutes to evacuate, but like I think there were still a couple people on board when they blew the front part of the plane up. They had dynamite all over the front and the back of the plane. They brought on 20 kilos of plastic dynamite or something in Beirut.
How long were you out of the plane before it gave up?
About a minute.
Did you see any bodies? You said there were some people boarding the plane started to blow.
Oh, well, see, they just blew up the front part, and then it just kept burning, and then the gas tank caught on fire, and then the whole thing blew up and burned. Tail section still stands.
The first of the hijacked planes, a Pan Am 747 jumbo jet, was blown up immediately after landing in Cairo. The other three met the same fate only minutes after all the passengers and crewmen were removed. The 1970 census taken in the United States revealed that the population has increased to more than 204 million persons. California replaced New York as the most populated state. Only four states lost population, with West Virginia leading the list, down 8.5% from 1960. But even as population increases, people die. In one of the worst disasters of modern times, a devastating cyclone with giant tidal waves killed over 250,000 persons in Pakistan. Coming up next on United Press International's 1970 in Review, an airplane hijack with a different twist.
The hijack occurred over Las Vegas, New Mexico. Immediately after taking over the aircraft, the hijacker allegedly said over the radio that he wanted to go to Washington because his rights had been violated. Addressing himself to the Supreme Court, he said he wanted $100 million in small bills delivered to the plane.
We'll look at the $100 million hijack next when 1970 in Review continues. What do you do if you work for a major airline and one of your pilots calls the control tower and says his plane, loaded with passengers, is being hijacked by a man with a gun? He'll give up the plane, you're told, if you get him $100 million. This TWA spokesman got such a call in 1970, and this is what he did.
Everyone really thought the request was for $100,000. So we went to First Merchants Bank, and they got $75,000 out of the bank in Leesburg and $25,000 out of the bank here, and it was in a satchel, and it was put on the runway the way he asked for it, and everyone thought they'd complied.
But that's wrong, apparently.
Well, he's unhappy, you know.
How much money does he want?
$100
million. Well, is there any thought about giving him $100 million?
If anybody could find banks open or anything, where would you find it at this time of day? I think this is the question.
And so began one of the strangest tales of 1970, a plane hijacked for $100 million. The hijacker felt he was cheated by the government some years ago. His way to get even? Hijack a plane to Washington, demand $100 million from the president, hold the crew and passengers hostage.
He was getting real nervous, and he said, "I hate to do this." Frankly, I thought this was it when he said that, because I had a better view of him, had my seat turned. All at once, he came out and says, "Send another message." And this message was going to give him one more chance to come across with the money. First, he said the $100 million like he had said before. Then he changed his mind and says, "No, make that 100 TOSACs. Bills not less than a $100 bill." So I sent the message.
What's a TOSAC?
TOSACs, 100-pound TOSACs, the old tater sack.
Believe it or not, an attempt was made to get the money, along with plans for trying to recapture the plane. The eventual capture of the hijacker was not easy.
The tires were shot out. The airplane stopped automatically. They don't go anywhere with flat tires on those big tires. And then the windows and escape hatches began to just fly out of that airplane. And people poured out over the wings and jumped off and fell off and everything. But all they wanted to do was get out of there. Here was this nucleus of FBI men who worked their way up under the fuselage. This door was open, and they stood up and looked, couldn't see anything. So one boosted the other one up, and he got a handhold and started to go in, and actually got inside. Then half came out again, as if somebody was pushing him out, and we thought he was going to fall out in the ramp. I did. And he was grabbing the door to hang on, and at this point, shots started from inside. And he was crouched and half trying to hold on, and he started to shoot back. But he scrambled right on in, still shooting, and another one was boosted up and went in back of him. In the meantime, this horrible melee started inside of people grabbing and pushing and milling, and
That's when the crew jumped the man, right?
This is what the crew told me, that when the FBI started in through the door, it was the first time anybody distracted this man enough that they could actually jump and start taking him.
The story of political kidnappings, the My Lai trial, and the issue of ecology coming up next on 1970 in Review. In Canada, two separate groups, both reported to be a part of the Front for the Liberation of Quebec, made kidnapping part of their strategy. One group kidnapped Quebec Labour Minister Pierre Laporte, the other kidnapped British diplomat James Cross. Mr. Laporte was taken from his home in a Montreal suburb on October the 10th. His abductors demanded the release of so-called political prisoners. Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau invoked Canada's War Measures Act, empowering the police to carry out mass raids and arrests in a search for the missing men and their kidnappers.
Nothing that either the government of Canada or the government of Quebec has done or failed to do now or in the future could possibly excuse any injury to either of these two innocent men. The guns pointed at their heads have FLQ fingers on the trigger. Should any injury result, there is no explanation that could condone the act. Should there be harm done to these men, the government promises unceasing pursuit of those responsible.
On October 17th, just 7 days after he was kidnapped, Mr. Laporte's body was found. He had been strangled. For British diplomat James Cross, fate was kind. After 8 weeks of confinement, he was released. Mr. Cross tells of his confinement.
They told me about 10 o'clock on Wednesday evening that they had, the police knew where I was. Nothing much happened for about the next 4 hours. Then the power was cut at, I think, around 2 in the morning. I was in bed at the time. They got me up. They took me into a corridor in the middle of the house. They handcuffed me to a doorknob. I spent the night.
In an agreement reached with the kidnappers, they were allowed to leave Canada and guaranteed safe passage to Cuba. After the preliminary negotiations, Mr. Cross and the three kidnappers rode in a police cavalcade to St. Helens Island, the site of Expo 67 in the St. Lawrence River. Canada's Expo Pavilion there had been declared Cuban territory for the purposes of the talks. In Fort Benning, Georgia, courts-martial proceedings started to determine the guilt or innocence of soldiers who supposedly took part in the massacre of Vietnamese civilians in My Lai in March of 1968. The name most associated with the alleged massacre, Lieutenant William Kelly. He was the leader of the platoon, which was in the village the day the civilians were shot. Kelly is charged with killing 102 civilians. Many people believe the big issue of the 70s will be ecology, the study of the environment and its relationship to human beings and other living things. Ralph Nader, a leader in this field, tells about some rivers and lakes in America.
Lake Erie is now so contaminated, you're advised to have a typhoid inoculation before you set sail on some parts of the lake. Cleveland takes its water supply from deep in the center of the lake. How much longer is it going to get away with that? The Buffalo River is so full of petroleum residuals, it's been classified an official fire hazard by the city of Buffalo. We have the phenomenon now known as flammable water. The Cuyahoga River outside of Cleveland did catch fire last June, burning the base of some bridges. I often wonder what was in the minds of the firemen as they rushed to the scene of the action and pondered how to put this fire out. But we're heading in river after river, Connecticut River, Hudson River, Mississippi River, you name it. There's some rivers right outside of Boston, New Hampshire, and Maine, where if a person fell into them, he would dissolve before he drowned.
More and more in 1970, politicians, businessmen, and just plain people became concerned with the direction the world was taking regarding ecology. Industry was criticized severely for polluting the atmosphere. Government was criticized for not demanding more controls for air and water pollution. In April, a day was set aside to call attention to the problems of ecology. Fittingly, it was called Earth Day. One of the organizers of the day tells what the purpose was.
We're going to be focusing an enormous amount of public interest on a whole wide range of environmental events, hopefully in such a manner that it's going to be drawing the interrelationships between them and getting people to look at the whole thing as one consistent kind of picture, a picture of a society that's rapidly going in the wrong direction and that has to be stopped and turned around. It's going to be an enormous affair, I think. We have groups operating now in about 12,000 high schools, 2,000 colleges and universities, and a couple of thousand other community groups. It's safe to say, I think, that the number of people who will be participating in one way or another is going to be ranging in the millions.
1970 was a year for women's liberation. You'll hear that story when 1970 in Review continues. ...1970 marked the 50th anniversary of women's right to vote in the United States. It was fitting then that in 1970 a rebirth of that struggle came about. Betty Friedan is a principal organizer of women in their fight for equal rights, 1970 style. The highlight of the year for women came about on August 26th, a day set aside by various female organizations to demonstrate nationwide their demands.
All kinds of women's groups all over the country will be using this week and August 26th particularly to point up those areas in women's life which are still not addressed. For example, the question of equality before the law. We are interested in the Equal Rights Amendment. The question of child care centers, which are totally inadequate in the society and which women require if they are going to assume their rightful position in terms of helping and decisions in the society. The question of a woman's right to control her own reproductive processes, that is, laws prohibiting abortion in the state or putting them into the criminal statutes are things that will be statutes that we'll be addressing ourselves to. So I think individual women will react differently. Some will not cook that day. Some will engage in dialogue with their husbands. Some will be out at the rallies and demonstrations that will be taking place all over the country. Others will be writing things that will help them define where they want to go. Some will be pressuring their senators and their congressmen to pass legislation that affect women. I don't think you can come up with any one point. Women will be doing their own thing in their own way.
Some of the demonstrations were reminiscent of a sorority initiation, but all in all, the women made their point.
This holy ground, I consecrate this plaque to the memory of Susan B. Anthony. In the name of the mother and the daughter and the holy granddaughter, women, we will now sing a her.
Hallelujah, hallelujah, let our voices be raised. Let the statue of Susan B. Anthony on its side to be raised.
When you talk about women in 1970, there's one topic you can't dismiss: the battle between the mini and the maxi. Women around the country protested the dictate of the fashion designers and promoters, the so-called fashion influencers. The women said the Maxi and the Midi were being pressured on them. Many formed anti-Midi organizations. They refused to buy the calf and ankle-length styles and even refused to shop in stores that sold them. Last word is that the women of the United States have won the battle. At least one famous designer has dropped his Midi Maxi line and is back to the above-knee hemline. The victory was praised by men the world around. 1970 in Review will continue right after this message. Women in 1970 didn't stop with the Midi victory. At a Senate hearing on birth control pills, they broke up one of the sessions.
Women are not going to sit quietly any longer. You are murdering us for your profit and convenience.
The girls and women of the Women's Liberation Front finally couldn't take it anymore, and so they broke up the Senate's pill hearings. In miniskirts, maxi coats, frumpy housewife outfits, they had filled up the Small Business Subcommittee hearing room. Their first action was to match the dull press releases from the prominent doctors with a snappy release of their own, carrying a scotch-taped real pill.
You all take the pill we handed out this morning. Everyone has a pill here.
Hearing Chairman Gaylord Nelson instructed police to clear everybody, women, reporters, and all, out of the room. He left. The only Republican on hand, Robert Dole of Kansas, said he would not mind letting the militants testify, and then he ducked out. And after some pushing and shoving with embarrassed policemen, the women left too.
The birth control pill came under much criticism during the hearings. Viewpoints differed even among experts. Here, Dr. Michael Newton, president of the College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, gives his view.
The evidence is not yet clear that these pills do, in fact, cause cancer or related to it. The FDA advisory committee made comments about this and said that there wasn't enough evidence to indicate whether or not these pills were related to the development of cancer. And I think that still stands. You have to be cautious about them, but I don't think there's clear evidence either one way or the other that they do or don't cause cancer.
Another expert was Dr. Roy Hertz of the Population Council.
Application of these medications in their present state of knowledge constitutes a highly experimental undertaking. That the individual called upon to take these materials, particularly for prolonged periods of time, should be regarded as in effect a volunteer for an experimental undertaking. I think she should be so informed. I think that the various aspects of our knowledge and ignorance in these matters should be made clear to her in as explicit language as can be done. And that on that basis, she should be expected to either accept or not accept this form of medication.
The upshot of the hearings was the decision reached by the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare at the time, Robert Finch. He announced the federal government had accepted a compromise warning statement which would accompany all sales of birth control pills.
The delicate balance we had here was to parade a long list of horribles which had shown up in a very minute portion of the population. When you weigh the risk-benefit ratio, there's just no question but what the overwhelming number of women using the pill do not affect these, but we're now putting them on notice. This is an unprecedented step. A lot of people opposed it, to put this kind of warning in every package that goes out.
The new accepted statement is shorter and less emphatic about the potential dangers of the pills than the three earlier versions of the statement cautioning women about the potential hazards of the pill.
Look at that. Look at that. Look at the flares going out from it. Look at that corona. This is really something. I hope everybody's getting it. You see Venus? Venus to the left, you see Mercury down there to the right. I can't pick out Leo at the present time. And notice the shape of that corona. This is really historic. I've never seen anything like this in any photographs that I've ever seen of an eclipse of the sun.
That was Dr. Franklin Branly, chairman of the American Museum, Hayden Planetarium, describing a total eclipse of the sun by the moon, which took place on March 7th. The shadow moving at 15,000 miles an hour along an 85 to 100-mile path began in the South Pacific and traveled across southern Mexico, Florida, and the southeastern coast of the United States. The beginning of a new era of the 70s brought the end to a phenomenon of the 60s. It was announced that the long-haired group which started a revolution in pop music was breaking up. Yes, the Beatles, they said, would no longer be. Well, all things must come to an end. So it was with the 60s, and so it was with the Beatles. The 70s are here. What will they bring? Where will they go? Who knows? You've been listening to 1970 in Review, a production of the United Press International Audio Network. This program was written, produced, and directed by Stan Sabick. Technical supervisor was Frank Shortino. This is Ed Cairns.